This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch. Before we begin our next story, an Olympic spoiler alert. If you plan to tune in to tonight's telecast, you might want to plug your ears. We're talking about men's downhill skiing, and today American Bodie Miller was back on the podium. He took the bronze medal in the men's downhill, finishing less than a tenth of a second behind Didier Defago of Switzerland. This was the first alpine skiing event of the Vancouver Games. Weather led to a series of delays. NPR's Howard Berkus is with us from Whistler, home of the alpine competition. And Howard, let's start with Bodie Miller. There were a lot of hopes riding on him 4 years ago at the Olympics in Turin. He did not medal. Different story this time around.
Yes, this is a good start for Bodie Miller to the 2010 Olympics, likely his last. He's got several events to go, and by getting on the podium this time, he gains confidence. He's had this mixed record, as you mentioned, not doing that well in Torino, not finishing in Nagano, two silver medals in Salt Lake City, so he's hoping to regain that. And one of the things he talked about today after the race was how rejoining the U.S. ski team was something that helped center him on his skiing. He said for him, it's always been about the skiing. Even though 4 years ago it seemed to be about partying too, he today reaffirmed this notion that for him it is about the skiing, and that rejoining the U.S. ski team helped reinforce that with him by being around his teammates and the U.S. coaches, by not being on his own. And he said it was an atmosphere that was very supportive and an atmosphere that will help him do well here.
Yeah, with a bronze medal. Now, the downhill, Howard, was originally scheduled for this past Saturday. It was moved to today because of rain and fog. What kind of condition was the course in?
The course was better than it has been. At least it wasn't slush and corn snow, which has been a problem on this course in the last few days. The weather here has been, you know, unusually warm and really wet, not very wintry. And that's made it very difficult to get the schedule in line with what they had hoped for. But what we heard from the racers, too, as they came off the course, was that while it was more solid and it wasn't soft, there were bumps in the course. And also the light changed during the day. The sun came out later in the day, and those skiers who came later in their runs had the benefit of seeing those bumps better. Bodie Miller was not one of them, and that may be one of the things that slowed him down in the last part of the course. That's where he did slow down.
Mm. Now, Bodie Miller, one big name on the U.S. ski team, another arguably bigger name, Lindsey Vonn. She has been worried about a bad shin injury, Howard. She took a practice run today. How'd it go?
Didn't seem to go well. She complained after the run that she was in quite a bit of pain, that the run was hard on her shin. She didn't say that she wouldn't be skiing in the women's downhill on Wednesday, but she still is struggling with this injury, and this is a big problem for her that doesn't seem to be going away quickly. She had a lot of rest because of these delays. We were all thinking, you know, that would help get that shin healed, but she had nothing good to say about her skiing today, about the pain that she felt as she came down the course, so we're wondering what's going to happen.
Okay, NPR's Howard Berkus talking with us from Whistler, covering the Vancouver Olympics. Howard, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Melissa.
We're going to hear now from someone who spent years engaged at the highest levels with Iran about its nuclear program. Mohammad El-Baradei stepped down in December after 12 years as head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. He joins us from Vienna. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Melissa, for having me.
We heard Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today saying of Iran, we don't want to be engaging while they are building their bomb, saying that leaves the international community little choice but more sanctions. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure they are building a bomb. There is a concern, Melissa, that their program needs to be clarified. There are, as you know, concerns that they have been doing some studies on how to develop a weapon. We are not sure this is the case, but Iran needs to engage substantively with the international community to clarify this concern. It's a very frustrating situation, Melissa, frankly, because it has been on again, off again for many, many years. When the Iranians were ready to talk, the Bush administration was not ready to talk, and there were certain conditions Iran has to fulfill before they start the dialogue. When Barack Obama is now ready to talk to them, they are into certain domestic hype of some sort inside Iran, and they are not in a position to put their act together.
You said that you do not believe, you're not convinced that Iran is building or has intentions to build a nuclear bomb. Iran has certainly concealed its intentions in the past. I mean, it had a whole uranium enrichment facility that was not disclosed until this past fall, which surprised everyone. What makes you so convinced that their intentions are not exactly that, to build a nuclear weapon?
I'm not convinced that they're entirely clean, Melissa, but as I said, I'm not panicky because I haven't seen any concrete evidence that Iran is actually building a nuclear weapon. But the solution is to try to see how to get Iran to turn around and make good in what they say, that this is a program for peaceful purposes. There's a lot of psychology there. It's at the end of the day, I believe that Iran wants using the nuclear program as a means to an end, which is to recognize Iran as a regional power. Whether they are doing it the right way, whether the West is responding the right way, there is a lot to be said about that.
Dr. Alberta, you have been accused by your critics as having been too soft on Iran at the IAEA. Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that you muddied the message to Iran. We're really engaging more in diplomacy than in the proper mission of nuclear safeguarding and verification. I wonder, as you look back on your time with the agency, did you do enough, do you think? Did you pursue the right strategy to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power?
I think I did, Melissa, everything I can within the authority I have. I don't have God's authority. I have a very limited authority. And, you know, you cannot just go and give them order. You have to understand where they are coming from, and you have to also try to provide them with incentive. And what the Bush administration and did not like to hear, that that they need to reach out to Iran without precondition. This was, for them, a heresy. Well, if you see what Barack Obama is doing now, is what I was advising at the time, that I didn't see Iran coming to the table with condition attached to the negotiation. Well, the Obama administration understood that right away, and they are offering Iran negotiation without precondition.
That open-hand policy that you're describing under President Obama, though, does seem to be met again with further intransigence and indeed provocation on the part of the Iranians. So what are the signs to you that that is, in fact, a policy that will bear fruit?
I think eventually it will bear fruit, Melissa. I could be wrong, but I don't see any other policy. I mean, you can have pressure. I'm not questioning that. But you have always, at all time, to maintain the dialogue. We have seen in North Korea, which is a perfect example, when the dialogue stopped during the beginning of the Bush administration, North Korea walked out of the NPT and then developed a bomb. When there was a dialogue during the Clinton administration, North Korea was not going the bomb route. Then when Bush administration realized that they need to engage North Korea, again, North Korea came back to the six-party talks. It is a frustrating process, and it is not an easy solution, but you have to use pressure and incentives together.
And to those who would say that the time for dialogue and engagement is long past and that the only way to stop Iran would be through some kind of military intervention, you say what?
Well, I say that this is the way to Armageddon. You know, I say there is no military solution. And I'm not the only one who's saying that. Secretary Gates said that a couple of months ago, that maximum, if you use force, you will delay the Iranian program but for a couple of years, but then they will come back with a vengeance. You cannot bomb the knowledge. Iran could go easily underground. If you will get every Iranian, even those who do not like the regime, rally around the regime policy. So this is where we are. I wish I have an easy solution for you, but all I know that we should not isolate Iran. We should not only use sanction. We should try to be creative. We should try to engage the entire international community in a way that make Iran turn around and understand that it will be in a much better position to integrate itself with the international community through a policy of transparency and constructive engagement.
I've been speaking with Mohamed El-Baradei, who stepped down in December as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Writer Ted Conover says that road trips have always been an important part of his life. In his new book, he writes, "Every road is a story of striving for profit, for victory in battle, for discovery and adventure, for survival and growth, or simply for livability." His new book is called The Roots of Man, How Roads Are Changing the Way We Live Today. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review.
Sometimes the gods indulge their weakness for literary irony writ large. There I was, reading Ted Conover's new book about the roadways that are reshaping life in six locales around the world, just as all the roads around my house began to vanish in a cosmic whiteout. It's been snowpocalypse here in Washington, D.C., a rare 1-2 punch of storms that have frozen the city to a standstill. Given that the only escape routes from my neighborhood are the rudimentary paths created by shovels, boots, and paw prints, Conover's account seems to be the only road trip likely to be available to me until the spring thaw. And that vivid armchair travel aspect of Conover's book is undeniably a great part of its appeal. His book is called The Roots of Man. Roots is spelled R-O-U-T-E-S. Get it? The mildly clever but phallocentric title is telling. This is definitely a boy book. If you sign on for the ride here, you enter a road warrior universe, which is pretty much all male. In traditional extreme adventure tale fashion, think The Perfect Storm or Into Thin Air, Conover tests his endurance by bouncing along atop fuel tankers through the Peruvian rainforest and in the cabs of semi-trucks across Kenya. He hikes a frozen river in the Himalayas, braves roadside checkpoints on the West Bank, and in Lagos, Nigeria, rides shotgun with an ambulance crew through the blasted overpasses of what's been projected to be the fastest-growing megacity on the planet. Women are, at best, relegated to the passenger seat on Conover's trips. Danica Patrick, Thelma and Louise, even Nancy Drew in her immortal blue roadster. It's as though these path-breaking American women behind the wheel have left only the faintest imprints on high testosterone highways elsewhere on the globe. Beyond implicitly confirming that the freedom to burn fossil fuel, however risky the trip, is a feminist issue worth fighting for, there's a larger dimension to Conover's book. Conover thoughtfully investigates how roads, especially in rapidly changing countries, are contested boundary lines where the demands of the environment, traditional cultures, educational opportunity, and industrial progress collide. Returning to Kenya, which he first visited as a reporter in 1992, Conover reassesses the toll that AIDS has taken on that country and reconsiders the theory that long-distance truckers sleeping with prostitutes along the Kinshasa Highway and other heavily traveled routes spread the disease between Central Africa and the continent's east coast. Conover is shaken to discover that out of the 12 young truckers he got to know on his first trip, 6 have died. He says, if not for the links to the outside, the virus might have stayed put. This is a cost of global connectivity. The same trucks that carry medicine in may carry all manner of germs out. Not all the roads in Conover's book, however, are strewn with desperate stories. The most comically eye-opening chapter here is devoted to China's love affair with cars. Conover joins up with one of the many self-driving clubs that have sprung up in Chinese cities and embarks on a 7-day road tour with a caravan of proud car owners who drive just for pleasure. Bedecked with club decals, the 11 vehicles zoom off down the highway, their drivers happily listening to CDs with titles like The Relax Music of Automobiles. Conover concludes, "It is reminiscent of a fading romance in American life, this crush on the automobile. Lord only knows where it all could be headed in terms of congestion and pollution. It is hard not to predict a slow-motion, multi-car pileup in China's future. But it felt unfair to raise those issues in the presence of the self-driving club members. They were out to have fun, the kind we've already had. Who are we to say they can't?" Conover may be overly sympathetic to the siren call of the road, but in The Roots of Man, he proves to be a discerning map reader of its global meanings and meanderings.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Roots of Man by Ted Conover.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Imagine you're sitting in a meeting at work or at home eating dinner with your family when suddenly you feel the need to walk. Not to stretch your legs, not to get some fresh air, but to walk compulsively, uncontrollably, without stop, for miles and miles until you collapse in exhaustion. This is the condition that afflicts the main character in the new novel from Joshua Ferris titled The Unnamed. And Joshua Ferris joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this walking man. His name is Tim Farnsworth. He's a partner in a high-powered law firm in Manhattan. He's got a wife and a daughter, and he also has this mysterious affliction that hijacks his body. What happens?
Well, I would say, first of all, that it's not really a feeling he has to walk, but really his body overtaking him and forcing him to walk. So it's more of a disease rather than a compulsion. He himself doesn't quite know if this is the case, and it's part of an element of the book that sort of discusses whether or not it's a mental condition or a physical, organic disease. But eventually it concludes more or less that this is something that he's simply not in control of.
One episode comes late at night. He's taking out the garbage from his home in the suburbs. He's wearing a bathrobe, and it hits him again. He's had a remission. Why don't you read this section for us, Joshua? This is on page 33.
He walked past neighbors' houses. He walked barefoot down Route 22. He walked past the supermarket, empty parking lot, and an eerie glow. He walked past the Korean Baptist Church and the Saks anchored mall into the dreams of late-night drivers who took home the image of some addled derelict in a cotton robe menacing the soft shoulder. He looked down at his legs. It was like watching footage of legs walking from the point of view of the walker. That was the helplessness. This was the terror. The brakes are gone. The steering wheel has locked. I am at the mercy of this wayward machine.
And often what happens is these episodes come in freezing cold weather. His wife, Jane, does this to try to help him. She packs up a survival backpack. She puts all kinds of stuff in it, a GPS device, energy bars, a first aid kit, because when he starts walking, he can't turn back. She wants him to have this pack on him all the time.
He has no control over where his body is taking him, and he has no control over where eventually his body will release him. And when it releases him, he has no energy to do anything but collapse in exhaustion. So it falls to his wife to take care of him and pick him up wherever he might be.
And he and his wife both seek all sorts of medical insight. They go to the Mayo Clinic and see all kinds of doctors. He gets MRIs. He takes bat wing extract at some point. But nothing can be determined. This is an unnamed illness, and that there, of course, is the title of your book.
It's unnamed. It's undiagnosable. It's essentially incurable. As you mentioned earlier, it's recurring and remitting, so he has long stretches of time in which he's not afflicted. And over the course of the book, you see one of these sections and understand the way in which Tim, and I think sick people in general, re-embrace life and recognize that which has been taken away from them when their sickness hits.
How did this come to you, this notion of a man who could not stop walking?
I can't reconstruct the exact idea, but I knew that I wanted to talk about sickness without any of those pre-existing back doors that some sicknesses have. Some of the pre-existing cures and sources of alleviation. When we think of cancer, you know, radiation and chemotherapy come to mind. I wanted to strip down this character to the very barest essentials and see what happens when sickness can't go away and it can't be answered by all of the medical technology that the country has at its disposal.
So the reader, too, would be bringing no preconceptions of what this disease would be.
Ideally, you would look at this as the essence of sickness distilled to its purest form and discover what that really means, what it really means not only to be an individual who is suffering from this completely debilitating disease, but also a family who has to struggle through the uncertainties of it and all of its demands.
This is a grim trajectory for this character. I mean, he's gets badly frostbitten. His body falls terribly apart. He loses his job, walks away from his family. And there is some redemption, but it's a downward spiral. And I wonder if you knew that going in, that that's sort of where this path would lead.
I wanted to track the length of a man's life. And I also knew that this was going to be, at a certain point in time, an unremitting disease. So he would be stuck with it for life. I expected as I was riding along that it really wasn't going to have any easy answers. And I'm thinking, this is probably not going to end happily. But hopefully there are some things in the book that alleviate that relentlessness for the reader. I think some grace notes that are given to each of the characters that, while maybe not happy in a conventional sense, do bestow some sense of grace upon them.
What was it like at the end for you as a writer to leave this character, Tim Farnsworth, behind?
Well, the grace note that I mentioned helped me enormously because it was difficult to sort of watch him toward the end of the book. And to leave him, I think, on the note with which I leave him was essential. It wasn't essential only for the book and for Tim, but for me as the writer. But it was difficult. I mean, whenever you work on a novel for a number of years, it's difficult to relinquish. But here in particular, given the circumstances, I think that I felt a particular closeness to him because of his suffering. And I knew that I was done, but I wanted to keep going back and making sure that it was perfect. So it was tough to leave him.
Did the ending change over time?
The ending, actually, the very ending came to me early on, maybe halfway through writing of the book. And I had always known that that's how I wanted to end it, but I didn't know when I would write it. And I ended up being in a Home Depot with my dad, and I wrote it on my BlackBerry because I knew exactly what I wanted to say right at that moment. And when I'm always completely useless in a Home Depot. So I took the BlackBerry out and started to write it and finished it in the Home Depot as well.
Which aisle were you in?
I have no memory of really being in there. I can only tell you what my BlackBerry looks like.
So something about the spigots and the 2x4s was inspiring.
The fact that I know nothing about the Home Depot or what's in it was inspiring me to think about other things. And so I just got on, well, here's how I'll end the book.
Well, Joshua Ferris, it's good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.
The new novel from Joshua Ferris is The Unnamed, and you can read the first chapter at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer, in for Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Congress returns to work after a President's Day recess with lots of talk about creating jobs, but not much they agree on. To learn more about what the government could do and what Congress is likely to do, we turn now to David Wessel. He's economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Okay, so this week the Senate may take up a bill aimed at creating jobs. What are the lawmakers in the Senate proposing?
Nearly all the members of Congress say they want to do something about jobs. After all, the jobs picture is really overwhelmingly bad. The government, for instance, estimates that there are 6 jobless workers for every job opening right now, and by nearly all forecasts, the unemployment rate could remain high for the next couple of years. So last week, there was some disagreements on substance and some partisan posturing. The Democrat and the Republican who lead the Senate Finance Committee came up with one package of all sorts of things, and then Harry Reid, the majority leader, quickly shot it down and said he'll push a smaller package this week. And the centerpiece of that is giving employers a break on the payroll tax they have to pay for every worker they hire this year that's been unemployed for 60 days, and then giving them a $1,000 tax credit next year if they keep those workers on the payroll for a year.
Okay, so this is Senator Reid, majority leader in the Senate's proposal for bringing back jobs. Do tax breaks have a good track record when it comes to encouraging employers to hire more people?
Well, Senator Reid has picked up a proposal that actually Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York and Republican Orrin Hatch of Utah have been pushing for a long time. But economists say that history isn't terribly encouraging here. It's very hard to design these tax credits so they reward employers for doing hiring that they wouldn't otherwise do. And it's hard to write rules that stop them from playing games like firing workers and then hiring new ones to take advantage of a tax credit. And then there's this big problem about if you do something generous, which could actually get employers to do something, it widens the already wide deficit even more. If you worry about the deficit, then you tend to do so little that it doesn't really make that much difference to employers. So it's not encouraging.
What other ideas are out there for creating jobs?
Well, it's interesting. The tax credit, payroll tax holiday idea seems to be very popular, both with the president and a number of members of Congress. But there are other ideas, none of which seem very popular with Congress. One is to simply get the economy growing faster by giving it another injection of fiscal stimulus. This is popular in the House, for instance. They might give a big wad of cash to state and local governments to reduce the number of layoffs that are going on there, or another broad tax break to get more demand going on the theory that if employers saw better business, they'd be more likely to hire. Another option, one that the government has tried in the past, is just to hire a lot of people and put them on the government payroll. But that seems extremely unpopular with politicians now because it creates a lot of short-term jobs and doesn't do much for the long run.
Okay, and of all these possibilities, what do you think Congress is likely to end up with?
Well, I think if Congress does anything, and it's very hard to know what Congress might do here, as Senator Bayh, who decided not to run for re-election from Indiana, said just yesterday, it's frustrating that Congress is unable to agree on something, even something as important to their constituents as jobs. But the most likely package is a relatively small one that has some tax credits for employers, because that seems to be the only thing that has enough support from a majority in both houses to get done.
And just briefly, David, is it possible that employers could surprise the forecasters and create lots of jobs without more nudging by the government?
It certainly is possible. If the economy recovers more quickly than the forecasters expect, and forecasts in the economy aren't a whole lot better than forecasts on the weather, we might find employers adding a lot of workers and not needing this government help. But there are fewer jobs today than there were at the beginning of 2000, even though the workforce has grown by 11 million workers since then. So we have a very big jobs hole to fill. And I think the feeling on the Hill is better to do something than nothing.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal.
Bodie Miller was a star at the Olympics 8 years ago and a flop 4 years ago. Yesterday, he won a bronze medal in the men's downhill, making him the first American skier to own 3 alpine medals. And he has still more races to come. At the ski courses in Whistler, British Columbia, the forecast calls for snow and fog, and too much of either could force more delays in the Olympic schedule. From Whistler, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
New snow makes it harder for Olympic officials to keep the skiing surface solid and consistent, and thick fog makes skiing too dangerous. Bodie Miller is scheduled today to go for medal number 2 in the men's super combined, which mixes downhill and slalom. And when he and other skiers finally got to race in the downhill yesterday, they were greeted by a crowd celebrating the arrival of Alpine. Two kids with fiddles played as the crowd of 6,000 streamed in, including a herd of flag-draped Swiss fans clanging cowbells big enough for Paul Bunyan's Big Blue Ox. The crowd was so relieved that alpine skiing had begun that even the rival Swiss and Canadians cheered wildly when American Bodie Miller raced. Miller took the lead in the breakneck, all-out, just-get-down-the-hill-fast race in the first chapter of a comeback attempt that could include as many as 4 more races at these Olympics. He was bad boy Bodie 4 years ago at the Torino Games, interested more in partying, it seemed, performing poorly on the slopes and abandoning the U.S. ski team for his own coaches, funding, and training. After the race, Miller said his return to the U.S. team and the Olympics was made
with a pretty clean slate. I didn't have a lot of baggage. There wasn't a lot of extra pressure. There wasn't a lot of business commitments. There wasn't a lot of anything. I just decided that I wanted a ski race, and if I was going to ski race, I wanted to ski race in a way that would make me proud and hopefully inspire other guys in the sport. And you know, that's a much nicer feeling for me than the way I was before.
The new way was good enough for a bronze medal in Miller's first Olympic comeback race. He was edged out by silver medalist Axel Lund Svindal of Norway and Didier Defago of Switzerland, who won his country's first downhill gold in 22 years. And boy, did Swiss fans celebrate. Some of the other skiers who raced said Miller could have won the event without the flat light that made it difficult for early racers to see challenging bumps in the course. Later skiers didn't have that problem. But Miller had nothing but praise for Defago. Fellow American Lindsey Vonn had nothing but scorn for the women's downhill course she skied in training yesterday. The bumpiness there, she said, aggravated her painful shin injury.
It was like jarring, you know. It was a fight just to make it down. You know, I think it's probably the worst course for my shin, but I just have to be able to grit my teeth and fight through it on Wednesday, and you know, hopefully I can still come out on top.
Wednesday is when the women's downhill is scheduled. The weather delays of the last few days have given Vonn a chance to heal.
Having this break, I can't even tell you how much it helped, and I'm really thankful that Mother Nature cooperated with me, and someone definitely is looking out for me upstairs, so I hope that they look out for me again tomorrow and we don't have another training run, and then I'll hopefully be, you know, a little bit more prepared for Wednesday.
Weather that would scuttle Vonn's training would also likely postpone Bodie Miller's second chance at a medal. Maybe today we'll find out which of these skiers is really charmed. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Whistler.